Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Tobin. I'm here on behalf of James Knight, the appellant who is in the courtroom today with us. May it please the court. This case comes to the court from a bankruptcy court order that authorized the trustee to assign what he termed to be good and valuable claims, we refer to them as the D&O claims, to the Bank of America in kind of a joint venture arrangement whereby Bank of America would prosecute the claims against Mr. Knight and several other defendants in exchange for retaining 90% of the proceeds while the trustee retained 10% of the proceeds. Now, normally that wouldn't be a problem, and we don't really raise issues with respect to the trustee's business judgment. This case is here because 6 months earlier, when the trustee and his counsel filed their motions to retain counsel to represent the trustee in the Knight bankruptcy case, they made much different representations to the court in three instances and in writing, as well as orally before the bankruptcy judge. Specifically, the trustee in his application said to retain the Freeborn firm that Freeborn had no connections, term of art in bankruptcy, and was, quote, disinterested. Disinterested is kind of bankruptcy shorthand for saying that Freeborn didn't have any claims, didn't represent anybody who had claims against Knight. Now, as an aside, if the trustee, in fact, did have claims under Bankruptcy Code Section 701, he was not disinterested himself and should have not accepted the assignment. Freeborn, for its part, filed two declarations under penalty of perjury. And they said twice that they didn't have any claims and they didn't represent any party that had any claims against Knight or the Knight's estate. Now, we've quoted those provisions from the applications and from the declarations verbatim in our briefs. And I've got them here if Your Honors would like to hear exactly what they've said. 6 months later, of course, they file this motion to assign these claims that they didn't have 6 months earlier to the bank. Mr. Knight, of course, was somewhat unhappy with that because he was told at the hearing on the retention motion that Freeborn and Peters, when I specifically raised the issue with the bankruptcy court, Freeborn and Peters was disinterested. It was repeated three times in writing.
Was there any specific mention of the director and officer claims in those hearings?
I'm sorry.
Was there any specific mention of the director and officer claims in those hearings?
No.
How is Knight hurt by this problem with the attorneys here?
Well, Knight is hurt in several ways. Knight is required to now defend against claims that should not have been assigned, that were the trustee said didn't exist. And
well,
he is required
never
to...
never said that explicitly, but I understand your position. He's got to defend himself.
He's got to defend himself. He's got to cooperate with the insurance company to make sure his defense costs are paid. And the claims that are asserted here in these...
Those would be the case no matter who is pursuing the claims, right?
Oh, that's right.
So how is he hurt by the problem with the selection of these particular attorneys?
Well, I can't say that he's hurt because Freeborn or the bank's lawyers are pursuing the claims, but that's not what judicial estoppel, as I understand it, is about.
Well, it is about fairness. I thought one of the questions that I had is whether the debtor here, Mr. Knight, has standing to even raise these objections. And I'd direct you, for example, I think there was a case called In Re Technic, in the bankruptcy court where I
yes.
thought you convinced the bankruptcy judge in a similar situation that a debtor did not have standing.
Well, Your Honor, no, I think that wasn't exactly what the Technic case was about. But putting that aside, Mr. Knight is raising judicial estoppel here where the court can raise it on its own motion. And Mr. Knight is the subject of these very claims. And these claims are not the kind of claims that are garden variety claims. These are not negligence claims. These aren't contract claims. These are claims that allege very serious misconduct by Mr. Knight and several other defendants. And it seems to me, Your Honor, that if you basically do a Google search of Mr. Knight, you'll find that these allegations pop right up. Now, this is undercutting Mr. Knight's fresh start from the bankruptcy court, which is what his bankruptcy was really all about.
Well, presumably nothing. If we agree with you that the trustee and attorneys did something bad here, why wouldn't the appropriate solution be to replace the trustee on the benefit of the other creditors, replace the trustee, get new counsel, and pursue potentially valid claims?
I think that you know, is discretionary. That's a remedy that could be applied. However, that does nothing for Mr. Knight.
Why does he deserve anything here?
Because Mr. Knight was at the hearing, and he could have objected at the time to the disinterestedness issue, and he was lulled into believing there were no such claims.
Somebody was lulled in this proceeding.
Your Honor, I think that Mr. Knight raised the issue specifically, and I think that he is being prejudiced by the pendency of the claims.
What do you mean by that? You raised it explicitly.
Well, we basically said, you know, they represent the trustee, and they said that yes, we've actually are going to amend the affidavit. They actually didn't have to; it was already in there. Both the judge and I and Mr. Lauder missed that. But I said, and then the court asked me, "Do you have any objection?" And I said, well, not if they're still disinterested. No, I don't. And the point was, I mean, disinterested is a term of art. I mean, as long as I was concerned.
That's
not
very explicit, is it?
Well, he said that they were still disinterested. He said twice.
You and Knight knew at that time that the claims could be asserted. You knew of the D&O claims, right?
Well,
the letters had been sent. We think we've got valid claims, right?
6 months earlier.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
So you know that there are these potential claims out there.
Well, wait a minute. We're entitled, I think, to rely upon representations by a trustee.
And why not explicitly ask, does this mean you're abandoning the D&O claims? I mean, that would have solved this whole problem, right?
Well.
I mean, it looks like a very clever trap that was laid, sprung, and now it may or may not work.
Well, Your Honor, we're entitled to rely upon declarations under penalty of perjury that no such claims existed. And we don't normally inquire after there's a representation by a trustee and certainly by his lawyer under oath that, in fact, there are no claims. I wasn't about to say, well, you know, are you kidding? Are you?
Well, these claims were the issue, were they not?
Well, they weren't the issue at the time.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that, Your Honor, is that when I was told, and the bankruptcy court was told, that they had no claims, that they were disinterested, that they didn't have claims to pursue, I took them at their word, and I was entitled to take them at their word. I didn't even have to attend the hearing.
What did Knight do in reliance upon that?
Knight didn't do anything on reliance, Your Honor. I don't think that judicial estoppel requires detrimental reliance under Cassidy and under Coastal Plains. It doesn't depend upon Knight's knowledge under Cassidy and the Coastal Plains case. Whether he knew about the claims or not, and there's a one sentence, if Your Honor would permit me to read it from the Coastal Court, it says, moreover, Browning's knowledge of the claims, italics by the court, or its non-reliance on the non-disclosure, even if supported by the record, are irrelevant. And judicial estoppel was applied. It's to protect the integrity of the courts. And I don't think that we want to throw out this court's decisions in Crivello and Milwaukee Engineering, Graybill, and even Galeen, that basically strictly construe 327 and make sure that disclosures are made and they're properly made and they're full and they're candid and complete. Here, that wasn't the case. Every time judicial estoppel is applied, somebody gets, quote, a benefit because the trustee is prohibited from pursuing what might otherwise be a valid claim. But here, there really is no harm to the other to the creditors. And the reason is there are six or seven other defendants being sued for the same claims under the same insurance policy. So
there's no harm? by losing claims against Mr. Knight, potentially worth millions of dollars, and with covered by insurance?
Those are the same claims asserted against other people covered under the same policy. They're all being sued by...
So we ought to take into account... So what ought to control here is the existence of the other defendants?
Well, I think that's a factor as far as the harm to the creditors, but harm to the creditors is never a factor in judicial estoppel when it's applied against a trustee. Otherwise, trustees would be immune from the doctrine. And we've cited a number of cases that say that trustees are not immune. And as a matter of fact, there was a case that came out yesterday from the Western District of New York in the Adelphi Communications case. We'd like permission to submit that as additional authority because it deals with judicial estoppel being applied against an estate representative. In that case, it was a Chapter 11 plan.
You could submit it with counsel, copy to counsel.
Certainly. And in that case, and certainly there was no discussion whatsoever about harm to the creditors because otherwise trustees would be immune from that, and they can make whatever representations freely and suffer no consequences down the road. Your Honor, I see that I'm actually past my rebuttal time as well. If Your Honor has any other questions, though.
I don't think so. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Davis?
May it please the Court, my name is Teresa Davis, and I represent the appellee herein, Bank of America, N.A. Pellett's brief below and before this Court focus exclusively on issues that occurred in Knight's personal bankruptcy case. As a result of those issues, counsel would like this Court to overturn the bankruptcy court's decision in a completely separate bankruptcy estate that is governed under Section 363. Through the use of judicial estoppel, appellant would like this Court to overturn the bankruptcy's decision in consideration of the Section 363 factors that governed the claims assignment motion and deprive a completely separate debtor's estate from valid claims that it owned as a result of issues that occurred in Mr. Knight's personal bankruptcy case. That relief is simply unprecedented. Contrary to appellant's argument, this case is about Section 363, and the bankruptcy court properly considered and ruled upon the claims assignment motion based on the factors of Section 363. Specifically, the bankruptcy court found that the trustee had demonstrated a sound business justification for entering into the assignment of claims motion, and the legal and factual basis for that motion was adequate to support the relief requested. That was the issue before the bankruptcy court in the separate corporate debtors case, not any issue of any representations that were made in Mr. Knight's personal bankruptcy case.
Are you going to address the representations that were made? They're troubling.
Well, Your Honor, I think while the specific D&O claims may not have been specifically addressed in the application for retention of Freeborn and Peters or in the declaration submitted, they certainly were known to all parties.
So why weren't they in the declarations? I mean, that's what 327A is about, isn't it?
Well, I think
Rule 2014 to get all that information out there, and this looks like a pretty troubling failure.
Your Honor, the goals and purpose of 367 is to make sure that the bankruptcy court has all of the material information available to it in determining whether or not the professionals that the trustee in a case...
I'm inviting you, I guess, to provide a legitimate explanation for excluding this information on what seem to be pretty significant claims from the applications for representation.
I can't speak to that, and perhaps Mr. Lauder can speak to that, as Bank of America did not file the retention application. Bank of America did not file the declaration. However, I think if you use the classic duty to disclose total mix of information concept that is out there, the D&O claims undoubtedly were known to the bankruptcy court prior to the time that the bankruptcy court made her decision on the retention application.
Everybody knew these claims existed, but nobody said anything about them. That's the troubling part, I think.
It may be the troubling part, Your Honor, but if that is troubling and if there is a remedy to be had, Section 328 provides that remedy. The remedy does not include usurping valuable assets from a separate corporate bankruptcy estate in order to punish or deter the actions that occurred in Mr. Knight's separate bankruptcy case. There is an adequate remedy under Section 328.
Which is?
Anything ranging from a reduction in fees, a denial of fees, a disqualification. It is up to the court's discretion based upon the information the court used, had available to her, and relied upon in ruling on the retention application. And in this case, based upon the judge's very extensive discussion of the D&O claims as well as other claims that were held by the separate corporate debtors' estates, in her order transferring venue of Mr. Knight's bankruptcy case from New Hampshire to the Northern District, she undoubtedly was aware of the D&O claims. And she had that order was issued just less than 3 weeks before the retention application was for her. And she extensively addressed those claims in that order. So to now say that she was not aware of those claims at the time that she was deciding whether or not Freeborn and Peters had any adverse interest to the estate, I don't think is a valid claim. And that brings up another point, Your Honor. Whether or not the existence of these D&O claims by the separate corporate debtor's estate was an interest adverse to Mr. Knight's estate. The bankruptcy court specifically found in ruling on the claims assignment motion that that was not an interest adverse to the estate, which is separate from Mr. Knight personally, because no recovery was going to be sought from the estate. These claims never belonged to his personal bankruptcy estate, and therefore that estate was not being deprived of an asset. No recovery would be sought from his personal bankruptcy estate, nor from Mr. Knight personally.
You're talking about the insurance issue here?
Correct. Any recovery that was going to be sought relating to Mr. Knight personally or his actions as an officer, director, and managing member of the corporate debtors that now owe tens of millions of dollars to their creditors would be solely sought, in the case of Mr. Knight, from the insurance proceeds. The representation was made in the claims assignment motion. The representation was made to the bankruptcy court, and the bankruptcy court found that compelling in ruling that there was no interest adverse to his estate.
Were there fraud claims as part of the D&O claims?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would those necessarily be dischargeable?
The fraud claims, would they be dischargeable in bankruptcy?
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure about that, Your Honor.
Probably not.
But we haven't sought to exempt those from discharge in his personal bankruptcy case.
I mean, if I were in Mr. Knight's shoes, though, I'd certainly be worried about that prospect.
He may be worried about that prospect, but I think that's an issue that's down the road, Your Honor. And certainly those fraud claims are, at this point in time, covered by insurance. Certainly his defense is covered by the insurance. The actions of all of the other directors and officers and members of the corporate debtors who have been sued in the D&O claims, that is before the court. And the relief, the unprecedented relief that appellant is seeking here in barring a separate estate from assigning claims that were valuable to that estate as some sort of a penalty for alleged nondisclosures in his separate personal estate, it's unprecedented, Your Honor, and none of the cases that he cites supports that.
Can I ask you, what's the status of the pursuit of the D&O claims now?
They are pending before the district court on motions to dismiss. That is fully briefed, and the court has not yet ruled on those. But I think it is important to note, Your Honor had posed a question to counsel about the other defendants that have been named in this suit. If the relief he was seeking were granted, not only would the claim against Mr. Knight not be able to be assigned by the corporate debtor's estate, but the claims in general he is seeking to bar from having assigned to Bank of America, thereby, through his personal bankruptcy estate, avoiding liability for any of the other directors and officers that were involved in the alleged wrongdoing.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Lauder?
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Richard S. Lauder of the law firm of Freeborn and Peters on behalf of Barry Chatz, solely in his capacity as Chapter 7 trustee of the estate of James Knight. Your Honor, a great deal has been made of the declarations and the affidavit by Mr. Tobin, and Your Honors zeroed right in on the issue of disinterestedness and conflict of interest and adverse interest. I will confess right up front, the affidavit, the declarations were not artfully drafted, and I apologize to the parties and to the court for that problem. But there was never, ever an intent not to disclose those particular claims, to hide those particular claims, or to do anything other than proceed in accordance with Section 327 of the Bankruptcy Code. It was an honest mistake. Mr. Tobin, as Your Honor has...
These were the main event, right?
Well, let me... You know, there were substantial disclosures in the application, in the first declaration, and in the supplemental declaration. In each one of those pleadings, there was a disclosure that Mr. Chatz was the trustee in the corporate cases, and that presumably he would have things that he had to do in his capacity as trustee to perform his duties in those cases that may impact on the personal Chapter 7 case of Mr. Knight. And so,
but
just as Mr. Tobin...
If everybody knew about the D&O claims, why not identify them?
Your Honor, it was, as I said, it was simply a mistake. There was no intent not to disclose or to hide those claims. As Mr. Tobin himself said at the retention hearing, which really was the proper place for him to raise this issue, well, I guess everybody, this is a virtual quote, it's in the transcript, I guess everybody knows that Mr. Chatz is the trustee in the corporate cases. Everyone knows that. And so Mr. Tobin was specifically asked if he had an objection to the retention of Freeborn and Peters and Mr. Chatz as trustee. And he said, no, I don't think so.
And you guys fell right into the trap.
We fell right into the trap.
Because of a failure to be explicit in the 327A disclosure.
Believe me, Your Honor, in hindsight, every future affidavit and declaration that we submit in this context will be definitive and very broad in scope. But it's like saying to Mr. Tobin, well, Mr. Tobin, you assumed that the trustee was abandoning his claims because they weren't mentioned in the affidavit. I presumed that everybody knew about the claims. Mr. Tobin acknowledged that he knew about Mr. Chatz as Chapter 7 trustee in the corporate cases, and that that the claims would be pursued. But, Your Honor, the claims have been pursued. Your Honor asked a question about the fraud claim in the D&O litigation. Mr. Chatz has done nothing to pursue these claims except assign whatever his interest was in the insurance proceeds to the bank. That's all he's done. He didn't file a proof of claim in the Chapter 7 case.
That point is really relevant just to whether the so-called insurance theory is a valid one for distinguishing.
Correct.
For saying that Knight really doesn't have an interest in these cases.
Exactly.
He's got an interest in the cases. The question is whether he's got much of a legitimate interest in controlling or influencing who pursues them.
Mr. Chatz did his investigation and determined not to seek a denial of Mr. Knight's discharge, which means those fraud claims that Your Honor asked about have in fact been discharged. Mr. Chatz did not file a proof of claim on behalf of the corporate cases in the Chapter 7 individual case. Mr. Tobin listed in Mr. Knight's schedules in the individual case that those claims that we're talking about were disputed and unliquidated. So they weren't really claims in the sense, in the bankruptcy sense. They are insurance claims under Fernstrom and Shondell, the decisions rendered by this court, well accepted for decades. When you proceed against the insurance, that does not impact upon the debtor. And Your Honor, I would like to make one more point. I know my time is up. And that is that if you look at Section 327 as a whole, there's Section 327A and Section 327C. Perhaps Mr. Chatz was a creditor by virtue of his position as Chapter 7 trustee in the corporate case in the individual case. However, Section 327C says that that a creditor can still represent another party in the case and be retained if there's no objection by the United States trustee and no creditor objects. Mr. Tobin didn't object. The U.S. trustee didn't object. The judge didn't object. No one objected to the retention of Freeborn and Peters.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Time. I'll give you three more minutes, Mr. Tobin.
The first point I'd like to make is that the only party that had an affirmative obligation to disclose these claims was the trustee and the trustee's counsel. Mr. Tobin didn't have an obligation to disclose any claims. Mr. Tobin didn't have an obligation to go to the hearing. Mr. Tobin didn't have an obligation to do anything with respect to these claims. Mr. Tobin was entitled, I shouldn't talk about myself in the third party, but I was entitled, I think, and Mr. Knight was entitled, to rely upon sworn declarations. These aren't inadvertent mistakes. It didn't happen just once. It happened in three occasions. And frankly, Mr. Chatz, under 701, was not disinterested. Shouldn't even have taken the assignment. Now, the other thing about 328 as an appropriate remedy, that's proven to be an illusory remedy. And frankly, it doesn't matter very much to Mr. Knight if the bank gets to keep more money or the trustee gets to keep more money. You know, being a lawyer, I just as soon see the lawyers get paid than give the money to the bank who would otherwise get it. So the 328 remedy, which is permissive, it's not mandatory, it's not preemptive, basically doesn't do us any good. Now, the insurance that we talked about, first of all, there was no record of any insurance. There was no policy. There was no reservation of rights letter, which is longer than the briefs that Your Honor have before you today. Before the bankruptcy court at the time, the retention motions were filed. These claims are $20 million. The policy is a $5 million policy. And at the time, Mr. Knight, of course, you know, now he has a discharge, as Mr. Lauder says, but at the time, he certainly didn't have a discharge, so it was very important. And there is no insurance exception under 327A or Bankruptcy Rule 2014. What are we going to do next? We don't have to disclose claims where there's a guarantor. We don't have to disclose claims where there's joint tortfeasors. This is a slippery slope. Your Honors have said in Crivello, in Milwaukee, in Graving, that bankruptcy courts cannot engraft language into a bankruptcy code section to come up with a result that they think is equitable. They have to apply the law as it's written. There's no exception for insurance-covered claims. And what are we going to do? Have coverage hearings every time there's a retention application? Under Stern versus Marshall and Ortiz, I don't think that the bankruptcy court would even have jurisdiction to determine the scope and extent of insurance that was covered. And who would be bound by that? The insurance company? Certainly not. As far as the 327C issue that Mr. Lauder raised, it's very nice that 327C might have been an alternative basis to affirm retention order if that's what we are appealing. It's not what we're appealing. 327C also requires notice to all creditors, which didn't happen. It also requires a full, fair, and complete disclosures of what the conflicts are. 327C has absolutely no application in this case. Finally, Ms. Davis says that because it's a separate case, the corporate case, that Mr. Chatz shouldn't be bound by his representations before the same judge in a related case and because they're two separate cases. Well, judicial estoppel normally applies in two separate cases in two separate instances. Bankruptcy is a novelty where you have ongoing cases and proceedings in two cases.
Thank you, Mr. Tobin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.